You are listening to an American Free Press podcast. Joining me on the line is Victor Thorne, author of his new book, New World Order Assassins. Victor, thanks for joining us today.
Well, it's good to talk to you again, Dave. It's always fun doing these interviews with you.
Yeah, me too. I have fun too. I learn a lot, just like I learned a lot from your book. Victor, you have 16 chapters in here, and of course a bibliography and an index, and it is, for the benefit of our listeners, 264 pages. And I got to tell you, I mean, I guess this is par for the course of whenever you read something from Victor Thorne, but the one thing that stands out in my mind when I read this stuff is, I spend quite a bit of time trying to stay up on things, but when I read your books, I realize how that's not the case, how even though I do spend a lot of time trying to stay up on things, I really don't know anything because, I mean, I could take any of these chapters, any of these 16 chapters, and I can tell you that I had no idea that these things were working behind the scenes. So the one thing that stands out to me when I read your books, and especially when I read this book, is that really the mainstream media is not giving us any of the information we would need to make a proper decision regarding these high-profile events. Is that something that readers of your books tell you, or you know, do they tell you something else?
Well, that's really what I try to focus on when I compile these books, is to give information that isn't presented in the mainstream media or by the government, because they're working hand-in-hand with each other. So really what New World Order Assassins is, it's the third book in a trilogy, the New World Order trilogy. The first one came out in 2003. It was called New World Order Exposed. And then the next one in, I believe, 2004, New World Order Illusion. So it's taken me really 8 years since that first one came out to complete this trilogy. And then if you include also the Hillary and Bill trilogy into that mix, because those also have chapters on these big events. And what I tried to do with New World Order Assassins, Dave, was really fill in the blanks of things I hadn't written about before these big events. So as you said, there's 16 chapters, and it starts with Marilyn Monroe's murder, not suicide, and ends with the Columbine school shooting, and then there's all different events chronologically provided in between there. So I guess ultimately what my goal is to have books with chapters on every one of these major events that's happened in the 20th century. So I have one or two more books to go on these big events, and I have a list, you know, like Chappaquiddick and things like that. But this book here really fills in, these are the big cases on Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Bobby Kennedy and John Lennon and Charles Manson and Princess Diana and all of these different events. So I just focused on each of them and really gave the behind-the-scenes story of what really took place.
Mm. On page 8 in the introduction, you say that what I'm covering are high-profile killings which occurred between 1962 and 1999. Let me just go through the table of contents and let our listeners know who we're talking about. Of course, Marilyn Monroe, chapter on presidential model, the murder of Marilyn Monroe. Chapter 2, Mystery Man Behind Evidence of Revision. Chapter 3, Mary Pinchot Meyer. Did I say that right, Pinchot, or is it Pinchot?
We say it Pinchot up here.
Okay.
She's actually from Pennsylvania, and a prominent family here, they actually have up at Penn State campus, Pinchot Hall. So her family was pretty influential up in these parts of the world.
Mm-hmm. Chapter 4, Murdering Malcolm X. Chapter 5, Killing King. That's, of course, MLK. Chapter 6, Sirhan Sirhan. 7, Charles Manson. Chapter 8, Kent State Bloodbath. Chapter 9, Arthur Bremer. Chapter 10, Squeaky and Nelson. Chapter 11, Son of Sam. Chapter 12, John Lennon. Chapter 13, John Hinckley and the Bushy Knoll. Chapter 14, Port Arthur Massacre. Of course, that's in Australia. Chapter 15, The Cult of Diana, DNA Princess. And Chapter 16, Occult Ritual at Columbine. One thing that runs through all these stories, or through most of them, is the Central Intelligence Agency. And on page 9 of the introduction, you talk about this. You say, this skullduggery is vitally important because the CIA became an amalgamation of many different factions. And you lay out what those factions are. Now, the CIA is, of course, an organization that's supposed to operate overseas, but it seems like they do a lot of stuff here domestically, don't they?
Oh, absolutely they do. And that's really one of the bylaws of the Central Intelligence Agency, is that they can only operate on foreign soil. But as you can see from so many of these chapters, maybe almost every one of them, that they have their fingers involved in it somehow. So that's one of the threads that weaves through. And the other ones, Dave, is, as I said in the introduction, there's all of these commonalities. And that's what I try to do with this book, is to weave together all of these varying forces, and not only weave together the victims, but also the perpetrators. And you see these people pop up in all of the different chapters. Of George Bush Sr. seems to always be around lurking somewhere, and J. Edgar Hoover, and James Jesus Angleton. So they're all on the periphery. They're all watching these things happen and have their feelers out and their people involved in it. And that's what really makes it interesting, is that you see, especially George Bush Sr. I guess the other one I forgot to mention was Richard Nixon. And he seems to be playing a part in all of these, especially the earlier ones. So with George Bush Sr., he's been involved in all of these operations since the 1960s. And of course, he was the head of the CIA under Gerald Ford, and then really was president for 12 years. I consider him the president for 12 years, at least for the black operations taking place. So even though he was VP under Reagan for 8 years, when it comes to Iran-Contra and all of those events, George Bush Sr. was running them. So you see these people keep popping up everywhere. And if you look at our government today, especially with George W. Bush, that he had a lot of these same players, or at least the next generation of players who were involved in 9/11 and so forth. So even though it's a historical book, it can be related to what's going on today still, because you still see the generations that followed that are still involved in these same type of operations.
Right, yeah, and that was another thing that stood out to me. Of course, the most significant thing was how little I actually know about these events, knew, because I read it. On page 16 in the Marilyn Monroe chapter, where you talk about how her phones were bugged. They were basically bugged by just about everybody, weren't they? I mean, the only people who didn't bug them were you and me, probably.
It seems like it. That's what's really startling, is that all of these different factions had bugs inside her place, so everybody was listening in. And so when you read this chapter on Marilyn Monroe, and it comes to the conclusion that she didn't take an accidental overdose of sleeping pills or commit suicide, but that she was murdered, people might wonder, well, how can you get this inside information? How do you know this? Well, people have listened to these tapes over the years that were recorded inside her house, and they heard the explosive arguments between her and Bobby Kennedy, and they realized that the actual murder didn't even take place inside her bedroom where her body was ultimately found, but took place at a different location, which is revealed in the book, and also the modus operandi that was used to kill Marilyn. So, yeah, you're right, Dave, that there were so many different people. I mean, not only private eyes that were listening in, but also intel agencies. Marilyn Monroe was an extremely dangerous woman to the powers that be, and when you look back historically, a lot of people think this blonde actress in Hollywood, how could she be a threat to the government? But when you read this chapter and realize the information that she withheld, she had to be silenced, and she had to be silenced that weekend that she was killed, because if she wasn't, there was going to be explosive news revealed to the world that would have toppled the presidency.
Right. And another thing that stands out in your book is that the people who are on the trail of these stories, all of a sudden, they're dead.
Right. That's probably one of the most important points in this book, because people ask me over the years, aren't you worried about getting killed with this research you're doing? And I never play into that mindset, because I don't view myself as any type of threat to the government. And maybe I should clarify that by saying I'm not an immediate threat. Because the people who get killed are ones who pose an immediate threat right now in real time to the powers that be. So with Marilyn, she had this information, and I won't go into all the details, but as you said, on a Monday morning, she planned on going public with what she knew. And even though the official story is that she overdosed and died on Saturday, it was actually Friday night when she was actually murdered. And then there was a big time lag in between there so that they could set the stage to make it look as if this poor depressed Hollywood star took an overdose of pills and died in her bed. That's really the key right there. And, you know, I don't get into this paranoia or hysteria that there's people lurking around every corner trying to kill me. Or you hear a lot of these talk show hosts on the radio. It's like, the New World Order's been trying to kill me for 15 years. And it's like, well, one thing that's obvious from this book, Dave, is that if the powers that be want to kill somebody, they kill them.
Right.
It's that simple. They don't wait around for 15 years to do it because the information that's so immediate right there that can topple them can't be revealed, so they have to take care of them. And when anyone who hears these hosts saying they've had a crosshair on them for 15 years is doing nothing but blowing smoke up them and trying to bolster themselves and really give themselves more self-importance. It's a rule of thumb that if you're in immediate danger to these people, they kill you, and they don't warn you about it. They do it, and it's over and done with. We have to look at it realistically and pragmatically, and this is the way it happens.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, you lay it all out for the readers. Let me just let the listeners know where they can get this book, and I believe there's only one place to get it, and that is at AmericanFreePress.net at First Amendment Books. Is that right?
Yeah.
And what you would do is go to AmericanFreePress.net, click on bookstore, and it's prominently placed right in the front. Click more details, and it is $30, and it's available. It's in stock, and it ships within 1 to 2 business days. So you can do it that route for those of the listeners who don't have access to the internet if they're listening to this on an MP3 player or CD. They can call 888-699-NEWS, N-E-W-S, 888-699-6397. Another theme, Victor, that is prominent in this book is how the mainstream media ends up always being a part of what's going on. On page 27 in the same chapter, Presidential Model, you say, Ezra Goodman, Time Magazine's Hollywood reporter, wrote a story linking Marilyn to the Kennedys. Not only did Time refuse to publish it, they destroyed every known copy of the article. Now, this is back when this was happening. Same page. Finally, decades later, Geraldo Rivera and a couple other people finished a blockbuster expose for 2020 on the Monroe murder, linking it to the Kennedy family. However, the day it was scheduled to air, October 3rd, 1985, so over 20 years after she was murdered, ABC President Rune Arledge pulled the plug on it and refused to broadcast the damning information. Why would Time Magazine destroy every known copy of the article?
Well, we have to look at these at the two times that they happened. In the early 60s, when Time Magazine was going to run this article on Marilyn Monroe and her ties to the Kennedys, this was so explosive, Dave, that literally, and this is no exaggeration, the House of Camelot, which is what they called the Kennedy administration, it would have fallen if this information came out. The presidency would have been destroyed with this information. So Time Magazine, realizing that this was going to happen, and I'm sure they got calls from the Kennedy family themselves, realized that, do we want an impeachment process on our hands? Do we want a president to fall? And the answer was no, they didn't. So that's why it was so vitally important for them to destroy every single copy of this article and not give even a hint that it existed. Now, if we go forward to the 2020 piece in the mid-1980s, it shows still the impact that this information has, that the public still isn't by and large allowed to realize the real inner workings. Now everybody has read, I'm sure, like the National Enquirer or some piece like that that links John Kennedy to Marilyn Monroe and all his womanizing. So people say, oh, he was just like Bill Clinton, you know, he liked the ladies. But it was much more serious and much deeper and darker than that, especially when you realize that a life was taken because of this. So even in the mid-1980s, I'm sure Rune Arledge at ABC, when they were plans to air this Geraldo Rivera piece, that the Kennedy family picked up the phone and said, there's no chance in hell you're going to air this. Do you realize what this is going to do to the legacy of John Kennedy and Bobby Kennedy if you reveal this information? So when you look at it in those terms, you realize that a book like New World Order Assassins is one of the few places that you'll ever, ever get this story on not only Marilyn Monroe, but all of the other 15 chapters that are included in addition to hers. So, you know, this is the deep, dark stuff that isn't found anywhere else. And still to this day, very damning and very dangerous.
Mm-hmm. I wonder where that Geraldo 2020 piece is. Anybody could ever get their hands on it.
Once it doesn't air, it's on the cutting room floor somewhere or in somebody's vault.
Right. And another theme, Victor, that seems to be running through most of these stories is the fact that a lot of these people involved in the murder of these individuals were Jewish. On page 32 in the Marilyn chapter, you were talking about Marilyn's doctors, and you say that it seemed as if nearly everyone in her inner circle was Jewish. Mickey Rudin, attorney, Dr. Greenson, psychiatrist, Eunice Murray, housekeeper, Lee Strasberg, acting coach, Hyman Engelberg, doctor, Arthur Jacobs, public relations agent, Arthur Miller, recently divorced husband, Roseman, Gould and Loeb, Fox studio owners.
She was completely and entirely controlled by these Jewish factions that you mentioned. Every single person intimately in her life was Jewish. And by the end of her life, she had finally reached this realization that she had to start cleaning house. And she was consciously saying, I'm going to get rid of these people, these vultures that are in my life. And she wanted to rid herself of them. And she was getting this newfound sense of freedom and strength and self-reliance, where instead of being controlled like a robot almost by all of these people, she wanted to break out and take destiny in her own hands, which is really reaffirming, I believe. And it shows that she wasn't this depressed, suicidal actress, but she was instead the exact opposite. She was someone who was taking control and not only getting rid of all the Jewish factions, but also all the people that had scorned her, like the Kennedys. And she says, I'm not taking this anymore. So even though it's ultimately tragic, if Marilyn wouldn't have been murdered, I believe she would have risen to even greater heights had she lived, because for the first time maybe ever really getting her act together, and really drew me to her because I've always liked Marilyn Monroe. And I realized that by the end of her life that she really could have had a good long life into the future, but regrettably it was cut short in August of 1962.
Why do you think it is that there's such an astronomically high percentage of people around Marilyn that are Jewish?
Anyone who studies the subject knows that the Jews not only founded Hollywood, but they've controlled Hollywood up until this time. So all of the major studio heads are Jewish. Once you start looking at the attorneys that they deal with and the acting coaches, it's the culture. I mean, it's readily admitted there's been books and videos produced about this, that the Jews own and control Hollywood. So being that she was in this atmosphere, then, you know, it's not surprising that there was such a monopoly on her, especially when she was the most famous movie star in the world. So to the people running Hollywood, she was a product, and they had to make sure that they kept control of their product. And Marilyn realized that she was a product, and that's another reason why she was breaking out of this, and she wanted to get serious acting roles and not be this blonde-headed bimbo that she was characterized. She was reading Dostoevsky and Arthur Miller and trying to become more intellectual and trying to get serious acting roles instead of these fluff pieces. So I had actually a lot of respect for her, especially what she was doing at the end of her life.
And the way that they killed her, of course, that's up to the listener to go get the book and read about it. Fascinating stuff. Chapter 2, you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, just real briefly, when you're talking about, you were wondering where the footage from the Geraldo Rivera piece. Well, the second chapter focuses on this mystery man who produced a 5-disc DVD called Evidence of Revision. And what he did was, for the last 40 years or so, collect the rarest of the rare footage associated with the John Kennedy assassination. And finally, a few years ago, he compiled this all together and put this DVD out, and I produced it at Wing TV. But he's a guy that, because of the nature of this information, that he doesn't want his identity revealed. So it comes out really generically that there's no indication of who produced it. And that's the way it's remained for the last 4 or 5 years since it's been out there. And this is information on the Kennedy assassination and also Bobby Kennedy and Jonestown and MKUltra, things that have only been aired maybe one time ever. And because of how dangerous they were, how revealing they were never aired again. So this is the rarest material there is, in my opinion, the best DVD ever produced on the Kennedy assassination. And anyone that watches it will be blown away by what they see.
And where can listeners get that, or can they get it?
Yeah, that's only available at wingtv.net, and it's right on the homepage.
Wingtv.net, okay. I would go through all these chapters, but obviously we don't have enough time. Chapter 5, Killing King. Martin Luther King, the state murder of an American radical. I think this chapter has so much important information in it. One of the main themes that runs through the book, and we talked about this, how it's the same people that are involved. Another theme tied to that is how not just the same people who are involved, but how these people are linked to one another. On page 79, the beginning of chapter 5, you say another angle to this story is even more interesting. Smear merchant McMillan, that's George McMillan, the making of an assassin, married CIA asset Priscilla Johnson, who in 1959 traveled to Moscow and conveniently interviewed none other than expatriate defector Lee Harvey Oswald. And then it goes on and on to talk about how Oswald's wife, Marina, was involved in that, and Joseph Stalin's daughter, Svetlana, defected from the Soviet Union. She stayed with the Johnsons' parents. Priscilla later penned Miss Stalin's biography. Reading this, it's almost funny because you talk about the 6 degrees of separation, but would anybody think that it's odd that in 1959, 4 years before the assassination, a CIA asset would make contact with an expatriate defector who really was nobody, and all of these people interlinked? Is this another theme that runs through most of these stories?
Well, it really is, because when you go into the mind control aspect of it, and I know that's not exactly what you're asking, but you're right about all of these people that here's Time Magazine again popping up. And they're the ones who were this George McMillan guy wrote the big article on James Earl Ray, who's the alleged assassin of Martin Luther King. And McMillan says in his Time Magazine article that James Earl Ray had this pathological hatred of blacks. Well, James Earl Ray wasn't a racist at all, but they had to float the cover story that he killed King because he was a racist, and on and on. But then you realize that he's married, like you said, to this CIA asset who in 1959, 4 years before anyone had ever heard of Lee Harvey Oswald, Priscilla Johnson is going to Russia, traveling to Russia. You know how hard it was to get into Russia back during the Cold War days. And she interviews this nobody, this defector named Lee Harvey Oswald. And what you're doing was setting up a legend or a cover story for Lee Harvey Oswald. So they operate like a chessboard, all these different moves and all these different layers and levels. And you realize that they're setting up legends for people, just like the 9/11 Arab cave dwellers that were blamed for 9/11. Well, they had a legend created for them in the years preceding 9/11. The same thing happens with all of these killers, as they find not only one Dave, but they find a couple different potential candidates for each big job so that they don't put all their eggs in one basket. With James Earl Ray, all the way back to his military times, they were grooming this guy to ultimately be one of the candidates, and ultimately he was the candidate that took the fall for it. As you read in this chapter, James Earl Ray didn't fire a shot that day, and I contend that all of the so-called killers that are outlined or detailed in this book, not a one of them pulled a trigger and actually shot real shots into the person who ultimately got killed. All they are is diversions. They're almost like mannequins, so to speak, that they're placed on the scene to get the focus of attention while the actual killers are firing the shots in the shadows. And we see that not only with Martin Luther King, but with Bobby Kennedy and George Wallace and all of these guys. So much so that I don't believe that Sirhan Sirhan fired a shot into Bobby Kennedy. I think they gave him basically a gun that was filled with blanks, and the real killer was behind him doing the actual firing.
Right, a starter pistol, like you said.
Right, right.
Yeah. Another theme is how the law enforcement authorities stand down for Malcolm X when they torched his house. It took 45 minutes for the NYFD to arrive. On page 91, talking about the killing of Martin Luther King Jr., when apparently Raoul and perhaps Ray or somebody else jumped into a car, it says, they then proceeded to barrel past Memphis police officers, and of course they were speeding, that didn't try in the least to impede their getaways. This is all evidence. You're not making this up. You're just putting the evidence together that obviously the mainstream sources don't want to put together. I guess another ridiculous part of this whole James Earl Ray thing is just like all of a sudden the Mohammed Atta passport came out of the World Trade Center and landed on a pile of dust intact when all of his items were just planted on the sidewalk.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
Do they think we're stupid, or do they know that we're stupid? And when I say they, I mean the people who are committing these acts. And when I say we, I mean not you and I alone, but everybody taken together. Do you think that they think that the general population in the United States, let's just stick to the United States, are really more concerned about getting up for work, paying the bills, going shopping, plopping down in front of the TV, watching whatever show is on at the time, rather than actually being interested in these type of things? Do you think that they also think that the general population, besides the fact they're occupied with more pressing matters, do you think that they think that they're not intellectually capable of wrapping their minds around stuff like this?
Yeah, well, I would say more they're busy with their own lives and they're uninformed. There's not a whole lot of people, Dave, that do what we do or what the American Free Press does and delve deep, deep, deep through these layers, go into the rabbit hole and find out the truth. So most people don't have either the intellectual curiosity or the time to do it. So they, like you said, they turn on the TV and they get their information and they're conditioned from birth, really, to accept this information that whenever these big trigger events happen, that Walter Cronkite or Dan Rather or any of these guys are going to come on and tell us the truth. And they accept it because if these stories aren't accepted and they go and start talking to their neighbors or their colleagues at work and say, hey, maybe these 19 Arab hijackers didn't do 9/11. And then they get all these cross looks and then someone tells the boss and pretty soon they're ostracized or fired or whatever, or they're known as the whack job of the neighborhood or whatever. So it's easier to simply fall within the center of the bell curve. And even if someone doesn't authentically believe the cover story told by the government or the media, it's simply easier to stay quiet and,
right,
and not voice these opinions. And, you know, luckily, there's a lot of people that we both know that don't worry about those kind of things, that we do voice our opinions and put this information out there. It's a small contingent, but if people have a true desire to get the truth about the existence surrounding them, then these are the kind of books that they need to read. And really what it is, in my opinion, it's empowering. Because instead of being a victim of the information that they give us, think of how boring, Dave, the world is if all we got was information given to us by the major networks and the big newspapers and the government. Think how boring and dismal that is.
Right.
I could never accept that, and that's why I broke out of those barriers that were placed upon me and find this other information, because I'd go crazy if that's all I was given. So,
right,
you know, it really empowers people to allow them to make decisions in their life then that they normally wouldn't make because they have all of this other information. And there's that old saying, you can't unring a bell. So once you realize that we're not being told the truth, you can never go back to that way of life again.
Right. Yeah, I think that was something very important that you said, using the example of somebody at work saying, oh, I don't think that those 19 hijackers did it. So people want to get into this, I guess, psychosocial comfort zone where to get along, go along, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And but after anybody read this book, they would have to change that mindset. With King, that might have even gone as high as the president. On page 93, you have LBJ began calling King a nigger preacher before snarling, that goddamn nigger preacher is going to cost me the White House. When you got this information, do you know for sure that he said that?
Absolutely believe he said that. And the reason why is that Martin Luther King became much more than simply a civil rights activist. This guy was becoming a real threat to the government by the things he was doing. Anyone who reads this chapter, there's excerpts from a speech that Martin Luther King gave. It was called the Beyond Vietnam, a Time to Break Silence speech. And he railed against the Vietnam War. I mean, railed and said what we are doing over there, and rightfully so, him saying this was an atrocity. This was a bloodbath over there for absolutely no reason whatsoever. And, you know, the Vietnam War is still the one I deplore more than any other, because the guys that got killed over there for no reason other than this domino theory that communism was going to spread throughout the world, it was ridiculous. And then also what King did was he wanted to have this massive March of the Poor on Washington, D.C., where he intended to call 250,000 poor people into Washington, D.C., right into the nation's capital, and set up basically a tent community there that would be a revolving community. So some of these people would stay there for a while, and then they would leave, and others would come in and replace them. And imagine, Dave, in 1968, seeing 250,000 people on the lawn in Washington, D.C., between the Lincoln Memorial and the Congressional Building, right in front of the Smithsonian Museums. 250,000 people, poor people, homeless people, in these ragtag camps, showing the disparity in income. Martin Luther King and me disagree in this area because he was big into socialism, into redistribution of wealth. I'm more of a capitalist. So we disagree on economic theory. But what he intended to do, to bring these 250,000 people in there. And it wasn't simply going to be for a weekend or for a week. He wanted this to be a permanent encampment in our nation's capital. When Lyndon Johnson saw this, and I'm sure everybody else, all the big power brokers in D.C., they're like, there's no way in hell we can allow this to happen. So instead of him simply being a civil rights activist to get better voting rights for blacks or things like that in the South, he was moving way beyond that and criticizing their baby, their Vietnam War, and also really the whole capitalist system. So when Johnson said, this guy is going to cost me the presidency, he meant it. Lyndon Johnson was best friends with J. Edgar Hoover, who had firsthand involvement in King's murder. So these two dined together, and if J. Edgar Hoover knew about it, Lyndon Johnson obviously knew about it.
Mm-hmm. Now here on page 109, talking about Sirhan Sirhan, the last page, actually, the chapter, page 109, we were talking about how it's always the same people. There's another example of it. Notorious mind-bender Dr. Louis Jolly West also examined Sirhan Sirhan after his arrest. What makes this point especially pertinent is West was a CIA contract agent who examined none other than Jack Ruby during his prison stay. Of course, Ruby, Rubenstein, shot his associate, Patsy Lee Harvey Oswald, after the JFK assassination. And this fella also was summoned to meet with Timothy McVeigh.
Right.
I guess once you're in that clique there, they only want to deal with the people who they can trust, right?
It's like the mafia. Once you're a made man, then they know they can rely on you. You know, in my Clinton trilogy, there's the coroner that the Clintons used every single time. Even when someone would have their head chopped off, this guy would rule it a suicide. So they knew that they could count on them, and both sides are compromised. The people they're using are compromised, and the killers themselves are compromised. So you have these mind benders. You know, Sirhan Sirhan, you had a guy named Bernard Diamond and Richard Condon, who wrote The Manchurian Candidate, and Dr. William Bryan and Reverend Xavier Von Koss and Louis Jolyon West. All of these guys went in and analyzed Sirhan and gave their analysis of him. And these are all guys, like you said, that were used not only previously with like Jack Ruby, but also almost two decades later with Timothy McVeigh. These same guys are showing up on the scene, and there's so much evidence that McVeigh, after he was arrested, was under the influence of mind control, and that's why he didn't really speak out, that he was some kind of murky operative in all this. And there's a good chapter in the Hillary trilogy about McVeigh and what he underwent. Yeah, so you're right, Dave, and I'm glad you noticed that these same individuals are used over and over and over again because they're part of the little club.
Yeah, you know, when I read that part in the chapter about that one fella being involved in all of these high-profile cases, I thought about Jared Lohner, the alleged nutcase in Tucson, Arizona, who on, of course, January 8th, I think it was, killed several people, including that 9-year-old little girl and Judge John Roll, and he wounded, of course, the political representative from that district there, Gabrielle Giffords.
Allegedly.
And I was thinking about the attorney who is representing this, again, I'll use the word nobody, when we talked about Lee Harvey Oswald. Judy Clark is his attorney, and she also represented Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber, also Eric Rudolph, the Atlanta Olympics bomber, and 9/11 co-conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui, and Susan Smith, the South Carolina mother who drowned her two sons in 1994. Now, I'll have to ask you this. I know you're familiar with this attorney and who she represented. Why is it that, or how is it that this one person can come from wherever she's stationed and come to defend this nobody in Tucson, Arizona? And does this tie into your research, this type of move here, using the same person over and over again for these high-profile cases?
Oh, it absolutely does. And being that Jared Loughner has no money, he has no ability to pay $50,000 or $100,000 for legitimate representation, then what this is, this woman is a court-appointed attorney. So, of course, they get someone who's inside the club, inside their little cabal. And as soon as I saw that she was going to represent him, I knew that he had no chance whatsoever, that this whole case is in the bag. And from the three articles I wrote for the American Free Press on Jared Loughner, one of them is actually available in Conspiracy Hall of Fame, which AFP is also carrying. But you see that there's so many irregularities and inconsistencies with the Jared Loughner case, especially how for an entire week after this event, the doctors couldn't determine whether the bullet that allegedly Loughner fired into the head at point-blank range of Representative Gabby Giffords, they couldn't tell whether it came in the front or the back. They couldn't differentiate the entrance wound from the exit wound. Now, how can this be at point-blank range where, you know, I've interviewed gun experts, and they said, this is forensics 101. Anybody could tell the difference between the entrance wound, which would be tiny and beveled inward, and the exit wound, which would be much larger and beveled outward or blasted outward. With my AFP articles, I'd listed all of the different reports. So I'm not convinced that Jared Loughner was even the actual shooter that day, especially of Gabby Giffords. So when you see things like this, and then he's represented by this woman who's been the attorney for all of these other high-profile cases, that she's one of the ones in the inner circle, and they don't want any contrary evidence to make it into the courtroom, and she'll guarantee that that doesn't happen.
Amazing. Unbelievable. In Chapter 11, I just want to make one or ask you a question about this. Chapter 11, Son of Sam. Of course, that guy David Berkowitz. You say on page 170 that the Son of Sam reign of terror extended 13 months from July 29th, 1976 to Berkowitz's arrest on August 10th, 1977. Now, I was thinking, and again, the evidence in here is pretty damning. Of course, I was a teenager at the time when this happened. I remember it. I remember thinking that, oh, there's this nutcase out there, you know, lurking around in the dark and shooting people who are sitting in their car making out. And of course, your chapter shows how ridiculous thinking that was. But I was thinking, why would, if this was more elaborate than just one lone nut running around, which obviously it was, as all your evidence shows, these dates seem that they might have some significance. I was thinking that at this time, of course, the presidential election was in full swing, and obviously somebody other than Gerald Ford was going to get in. Could this have been part of a plan by the power elites to somehow have a negative impact on Carter's election possibilities?
Well, it's interesting because not only was the election going on, but it was also our nation's bicentennial, and that was the big days right at the beginning of disco, and New York City was really a happening place at that time, and punk rock had just begun there, and a lot of things going on there. And what Son of Sam did was he terrorized a city for over a year. As you mentioned, that there were multiple quote-unquote Son of Sams, and he was involved in this, obviously, but he wasn't the only gunman to go in, you know, kill these people, as can be derived from the physical descriptions and automobiles that were seen at the crime scenes, that, you know, he wasn't the only one. And what this has to do with Jimmy Carter, the election, I'm not really sure there, Dave, but more so, I think what's important is we start delving into this occult world. And if you get into Sirhan Sirhan and the Manson case and these guys, that all of them, you see this thread of Aleister Crowley, Scientology, and Satanism and things like that. And the individuals surrounding the Son of Sam case were undoubtedly involved in this stuff up to their necks, even at Untermeyer Park, where these little rituals were going on and they would kill animals and have their little masses, so to speak, like an occult underground. And this was the real underbelly that started to surface. You know, you can trace it back in America all the way back to Aleister Crowley and his arrival in America, and then L. Ron Hubbard and Jack Parsons. And these are some stories that I cover in a book called Reality Bomb. People shouldn't discount this, that it doesn't really make the nightly news a whole lot, but it is ever present. And when you look at the highest corridors of power, these individuals, they're definitely into the occult and these secret societies and this forbidden knowledge, so to speak. So the Son of Sam chapter, I think, really shows it more than any other in this book. There's things going on that are really dark and dangerous, and these people are trying to harness those forces.
Yeah, I picked up on that. Absolutely. Just for the benefit of our listeners, before we move to the next chapter, can you give them a brief description of who this fellow is, Aleister Crowley, and why he's significant?
Aleister Crowley was described in England as the wickedest man in the world. He was a practitioner of black magic or Satanism or the occult. He was a poet and a definite libertine. He was a mountain climber and a chess expert. And one of the most fascinating individuals ever, he was also a part of British intelligence. And he traveled the world. He ended up becoming a hardcore junkie and had a great influence on the 60s counterculture. He was on the cover of the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper album. He was a great influence on Jimmy Page from Led Zeppelin. And really, Scientology itself is derived from a lot of Aleister Crowley's writings and philosophy. So he was a man who said, "Do what thou wilt shall be the whole of the law." And basically didn't follow any rules, did what he wanted to, and a really influential man. A lot of people used his material, and he was a wicked man. He was a wild guy. And really the man, I would say, who popularized or brought the occult to America in the early 1900s.
Okay, thanks. Let me just give our listeners some website addresses and some phone numbers for the purchase of this amazing book, New World Order Assassins by Victor Thorne. You can go to AmericanFreePress.net, click on the bookstore tab, and you'll see New World Order Assassins right in front of you. Just click on more details, and you can purchase it right through there. It is in stock. Price is $30, and you can order it right here on this website. You can just add it to cart, however many copies you want. One for yourself, one for a person who you'd like to introduce to these facts that have long been overlooked by the mainstream media. Or if you don't want to do it online for whatever reason or you can't, you can call 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-NEWS. And of course, news breaks down into 6397. So 888-699-NEWS. Chapter 7, because we spoke earlier, and you told me that your favorite chapter was Chapter 7, the Charles Manson case. In here, you're talking about, and this is on page 111, you say that a particular researcher claims that the same team that assassinated JFK, RFK, and MLK also orchestrated the Manson killings. Do you believe that?
Oh, I absolutely do. And yeah, the woman's name is Mae Brussel, and she's included in the Conspiracy Hall of Fame book. She was located in California, and she did phenomenal research back in the 1960s, the 1970s. She was actually, Dave, the first woman, the first person maybe, to actually buy the entire Warren Commission report and read it and start analyzing it. So the Warren report came out, and they said, "Oh yeah, Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone nut assassin, and here's the evidence, here's the report." And she said, "Well, maybe I should buy this and see for myself." And she bought the entire volume, you know, I think it was multiple volumes, and read it, researched it, and realized there were so many glaring inconsistencies in this commission that it set her on her path. So she was one of the early pioneers of conspiracy research who really delved deep into the murk of all this stuff. And I fully believe that. You know, there's a small cabal of, it's a murder incorporated is what it is, and they go to the same people all the time. So even though the Manson helter-skelter slayings were quite different than everything else we've been talking about today, it still had a great impact on what was going on in the world at that time. And I believe that the whole Nixon, J. Edgar Hoover cabal realized that a genie had been let out of the bottle with the 60s counterculture, and they needed a way to end this because the protests were getting bigger, the festivals like Woodstock and Altamont were getting bigger, and they were becoming more and more rebellious. So they needed some kind of dark force to come in here and really put the kibosh on the flower power movement. And they found that individual in Charles Manson, who I believe was sheep-dipped right from the beginning and a part of this whole intel process. And I'd really liken him to Lee Harvey Oswald or Timothy McVeigh in that he was knowingly involved in the operation. He simply didn't know what the entire operation entailed. So he was in there on a need-to-know basis. The best evidence of that is after he was arrested, he told somebody, his exact quote was, he says, "I want to know who was peeing on my leash." So he was tethered. Here's a guy that was in prison essentially his entire life, and they let him out, and he becomes this guru, flower child guy. He became Jesus Christ to his followers. They authentically believe that. the number of crimes this guy committed, not only statutory rape and theft and drug dealing and violence and all that, he couldn't get arrested for the life of him until the Tate LaBianca slayings. And then, of course, even then, they let this play out for another 4 months until he was finally arrested and brought in. Yeah, I definitely think he was sheep-dipped and unwitting participant in it.
Yeah, for the benefit of our listeners, explain that sheep-dipping.
Essentially, it's a process where a person is given one image, but it's changed then for a different effect, and this person becomes a fall guy. And they're tricked into becoming the fall guy or doing something that incriminates them so that it's ultimately used against them at a later date. So with Charles Manson, it's my theory from all the research I've done that here he is sitting in prison. There were people inside these prisons that realized Charlie had a gift. He had this charisma. He had this rap to him, and he had this musical ability. And they went up to him and said, "Hey, Charlie, how about if you play this role for us? You go out there, the hippie guru, and get this little following, and we're going to keep away from you. You can do what you want. You can have all the orgies and all the LSD trips and everything you want. It'll be hands off." And Charlie's like, "That's a pretty good deal, you know?" So here he is in the can his whole life, and all of a sudden, in the snap of a finger, he goes out there, and it's San Francisco flower power, and he goes down to L.A. and gets this family of ragtag runaway kids and goes up to Spawn's Ranch and just has the craziest time ever. And he's dealing drugs, and he's hanging out with bikers and all of these things. And then, ultimately, the Tate LaBianca slings came in August of 69, and it completely set L.A. on edge. I mean, these were the bloodiest, goriest, most sensational killings ever in America up until that time. The glitterati out there in L.A., everyone was going out and buying guns and locking their doors and freaking out. When they finally arrested Manson in December of 69, here they put his face on the cover of Life magazine and the long hair and all the hippie kids. "Don't pick up hitchhikers now. These kind of people aren't to be trusted, and look at what they've done." In effect, it was one of the big contributing factors to the end of the counterculture of the 60s. And the other event that really drove the other stake into it is another chapter included in this book, and that was the Kent State Massacre. So Helter Skelter played a big role in ending what was the anti-war, flower power, peace protester movement.
Another part of this amazing book that got me thinking was you must have read, I guess, thousands of books and tens of thousands of articles to be able to recount all this stuff. This is probably, I guess, close to your 30th book, right?
Yeah, somewhere. I don't know exactly how many, but probably around 30 books published.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been researching the stories that have gotten basically no attention from the mainstream media?
Well, I started delving into conspiracy per se in February of 1990, so I remember that date like it was yesterday. So that's officially when I began. I mean, I remember when I was a kid coming home from school and watching the Watergate hearings and reading Time magazine and watching Walter Cronkite talk about the Vietnam War and the body count and 50,000 U.S. soldiers dead. So I've had an interest in this my entire life. As soon as I saw my first William Cooper video, that's when it all started, and it's become obsessional since then. So it's a never-ending journey. And, you know, as much as I've already learned, there's still so much more on a daily basis that I continue to keep learning. It's, I guess, basically a part of my nature now. It's a part of who I am, and I just have this thirst for trying to find out what the truth is, the essence of what's going on around us. You know, I can't simply accept the status quo when I can't put my head in the sand like an ostrich. And it does a lot of, I guess, psychic damage to a person to realize that, in essence, everything we've ever learned and everything we've ever been taught and everything we've ever accepted is by and large a lie that's been fed to us. So you really have to change your whole mode of thinking and the way you address the world after learning this stuff. And I believe, really, Dave, is that's why most people can't take that final step into this world that we exist in, because it's simply too troubling for them. It shatters everything, the entire foundation of their entire life, and they're not willing to have it shattered. It's easier to go back and watch American Idol and read the daily newspaper and say, "Oh, okay, I'll accept that as what happened." But for me, that's not good enough.
Thank goodness for that. Thank goodness you're out there writing this stuff, because, like I said, I try to stay on top of things, but these are all facts. And yes, probably people want to get into that comfort zone. But I would urge that who's ever listening to this broadcast and you're not familiar with what we're discussing here and what you're hearing is kind of like, wow, what are they talking about? Pick up the book and read the facts. These are absolute facts. And the way to do it is go to the American Free Press website, AmericanFreePress.net, click on the bookstore tab, and you'll see Victor's book. It's got a couple of skulls on the front with some sights and looks like a map of the world in red, and it's dripping like blood. It's a cool cover. New World Order Assassins by Victor Thorne. Or you can call 888-699-NEWS. That's 888-699-NEWS. Victor, do you have any parting thoughts before we close out the interview?
I just want to thank you and American Free Press for putting this book out there and allowing this information to be read by a wide variety of people. And if anyone wants to really understand, really truly understand the way the world operates, and if you want to take off your rose-colored glasses and see the truth, then this is a great place to start. And, you know, this is one of the most enjoyable books I ever wrote because all of these subjects, every single one of them, I've been highly interested in over the years. And some of the early ones, like Marilyn Monroe, I was too young to actually remember, but I'd done research in later years. Despite the dark nature of it, is a real joy to go in there and find out what was really happening. And there's so much information, and you know, through the research, you know, I found stuff that is mind-boggling. And when you put it all together in one place and then weave these different threads through it, you realize that this is the way our world works right now. And it's challenging in a lot of senses, but as I said earlier, it also gives people the ability to rise above and go to the next level. And if we're here for any reason, Dave, I believe that's one of them, is to keep rising up through the levels and becoming more and more aware of what our existence really entails, and not only the good of it, but the bad. And this chronicles this murder incorporated that's been carried out by not only our government, but as you can see from the Princess Diana chapter and the Port Arthur chapters, that this is happening in foreign countries too. So it's not solely a thing of the United States, that all world governments, which I view as evil, all world governments engage in this type of behavior. And right here it is laid out, 16 of the cases in many of my other books. There's other ones too. So it's all there if people want it.
Yeah, they should. I'm so glad that I had the opportunity to read this because, like I said, I didn't know anything. And now I know a lot more. And I'd prefer to know what's going on rather than not know, even though it is, like you said, it can be difficult to swallow. It's really not palatable for a lot of people. But I think once you get past that point of not being able to swallow it, once you get past that point, then it's just like another fact that would be thrown your way. It might be uncomfortable initially, but after you get acclimated to it, it's quite comfortable. And not only that, it's just like the next part of research, right? I mean, that's all it would be. New World Order Assassins by Victor Thorne, available from AmericanFreePress.net or 888-699-NEWS. 16 chapters, 264 pages long. It's $30 plus shipping and handling, I would imagine. Victor Thorne, I want to thank you so much for the time you took out today to explain all this to our listeners. And most importantly, thank you for writing this wonderful book.
Well, thank you too, Dave, and always great doing interviews with you, and I look forward to more of them in the future, so keep up the good work, okay?
Me too. Thanks, Victor.